This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Prior to the 1800s, Japan was closed to trade with most of the rest of the world. In fact, in 1848, when U.S. Commander James Biddle led the first successful trade negotiation with Japan, he returned advising Congress that any further negotiations would need to be backed up with a show of force. 4 years later, Commodore Matthew Perry obliged, threatening force if he was denied permission to present a letter from President Millard Fillmore to the Emperor requesting that trade between Japan and the U.S. begin. What a difference a few centuries have made. Today, the United States is Japan's largest trading partner, and we consider Japan among our closest allies. The impact of that trade and our friendly relations is felt here in Charlotte, where 91, now we vacillated on the number here between 91 and 117, but we have discovered the number is 91 Japanese-owned companies employ more than 5,000 people. Ichiro Fujisaki was Japan's ambassador to the United States from 2008 to 2012. Today he is president of the America-Japan Society and still working to maintain our nation's friendly relations, to grow trade, engage in political partnerships, and encouraging cooperation on defense initiatives. Ambassador Fujisaki is in Charlotte under the auspices of the World Affairs Council of Charlotte and joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Michael-san, for having me today.
I should mention that the ambassador is speaking at noon today at the City Club. There are a few seats available, and you can just show up at the City Club at noon, and I'm told they will try to accommodate you. Although we've heard talk of Charlotte attempting to become a global city, in a way we already are. We did a program about this about a week ago. There are these 91 Japanese companies. That puts Japan just behind Germany, the United Kingdom, and Canada in terms of foreign investment in our city. And that may surprise a lot of people listening. 20 of these Japanese firms have their U.S. headquarters here in Charlotte or the Charlotte region. So as a longtime Japanese leader, somebody with a global outlook, former ambassador to the United States, somebody with an intimate understanding of relations between our two nations, does it surprise you that there's such a Japanese influence here?
No, not at all. I think this North Carolina, Charlotte, is an attractive place for Japanese to come and invest because of its investment environment. And all the big countries would look at the compare very carefully investment environment, what kind of tax incentives they have, how's the labor condition. And so I think it's very natural that companies are looking towards this area. One thing that I'd like to correct you is that U.S.-Japan relations is one of the most important relations for us, the most important. However, that as for trade nowadays, number one trading partner for United States or Japan is China. But still, we are the overall the most important relations.
You know, when we see stories about Japan in this country, a lot of it focuses on the how you educate children in Japan, and what we see is a rigorous elementary education up through high school and college, and then we compare it to our own, and some of us just scratch our heads. When any company wants to locate, they want in an area, they want an educated, skilled workforce. What's the difference that you see between young people leaving high school, or the equivalent to high school, and the universities in Japan to our own?
I'm not a professor now, but I'm not being trained as an educator. But what they say is that up until grade school, junior high, and high school, Japanese education has some merit because they would because of the very rigorous college entrance examination, people have to remember a lot and memorize. And there's a huge amount of work that we require young kids to do. Mm-hmm. But the weakness of the Japanese education is twofold. One is that after the college entrance examination, there has been a tendency that the students are sort of relieved and do not work as rigorous as here. Second, because of this competition for memorizing things. They do not really get into discussions, debates, question and answers like which happens here. And that kind of training is a little lacked in Japanese education. So I do not say that, Japanese education in whole is a lot better than United States. Each side has a good side and side that has to learn from each other.
Okay. Japan recently began, I think, participation in something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which this country is also a member of. The aim of that partnership is to create a comprehensive, high-standard free trade agreement among Asia-Pacific countries. How might Charlotte benefit from that partnership and from that free trade agreement? Because a lot of people here are still angry about NAFTA, which was the North American free trade agreement. How would we benefit in Charlotte from that?
I cannot speak on behalf of Charlotte, but for Japan, when this Trans-Pacific Partnership was proposed, we had been pondering for a while. We were one of the last ones to join the negotiations because we have weak agriculture, and our farmers were very reluctant to join. However, as this is the rule setting for Asia-Pacific, and if the major countries like United States, Canada, Mexico, and Australia, and some of the important ASEAN countries are joining, this will be the sort of rule of Asia-Pacific in the future. And we could not be put in a place where we will be set aside from that kind of rule setting. So we joined the negotiations, and now we are rigorously negotiating with the United States and other countries, and we hope that things will be coming to close soon. We don't have any... I'm not informed of the individual negotiations, but... And I think it's in trade negotiations, in short, there's a it's not a easy win-win game. It's totally win-win game, but in some quarters will be hit, some quarters will make profits. So it's not a zero-sum game, but overall win-win. But you have to take care of some of the weaker segment or sectors so that so as for Charlotte, we have to look at individual sectors, industries, if they need some support or not. That is, I'm not sure. I cannot speak for that.
But would it help the Japanese-owned businesses in Charlotte, this agreement? Or could it also hurt them?
For Japanese business, I think, in general, I think it'll support it. The Japanese industries, but I have not really looked individually, so I cannot just make an easy judgment on that.
We've also been talking, in this city at least, about the opening of this intermodal facility at the airport. I'm not sure you're familiar with that, but there's this hope that we will become an inland port because we've built this major facility at the airport where cargo can come in on rail lines and be distributed to almost half the U.S. population in 24 to 48 hours from here, and that would really go into full swing when the Panama Canal is fully widened to accommodate much larger ships carrying far more cargo from the West Coast or the Pacific to the Atlantic, and then using the ports of Wilmington or Charleston to get the cargo through rail lines to here. When that happens, And if we realize these hopes of becoming an inland port, will that make Charlotte even more attractive for Japanese?
I think so, because I always was very much impressed with this opening up the port, the huge facilities in Houston or Charleston, all those places, and if that could be spread through inland and railway network, that could change the whole transportation system. If this project of Charlotte could be developed as you have just described, that may change really the total picture. Yeah.
What do we import? We know about Sony, so so we know that we import a lot of electronics from Japan. Mm. But what else do we import from Japan?
Well, as for imports from Japan, it is changing too, because a lot of Japanese companies are now trying to invest and manufacture in United States, not like just exports. So many of those things that are exported are materials, auto parts or electronic parts, which would be necessary to produce the final products. And I think that tendency will continue.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, the Toyota Automobile Company was fined the greatest amount of money ever by an automobile company for evidently lying to its customers about problems with the accelerator on some Toyota and Lexus models. I think it was in excess of $1 billion. We have our own problems with General Motors in this company, with their situation with faulty ignition switches, which caused 12 deaths. But Japanese companies are known for being Japanese. The Japanese are known for being honorable people. So what happened there with Toyota?
I have seen the report about that compromise, the Toyota company accepting the jurisdiction. But I have not really read through the verdict or the agreement, so it's difficult to make a comment on that. When this thing happened, I was in United States, and I was watching the Senate and Congress, discussions, and when Toyota President came and made statements, and I really thought that this should be dealt with fairness by American Senate Congress, not try to discriminate against foreign companies. And I think they didn't do that. And I think the companies should honorably tell everything that they know, and because this relates to the human lives, and it's the safety is the most important thing. And I think they have been cooperating. Toyota has been cooperating very much with the jurisdiction to try to reveal things.
Yes. Former ambassador of Japan to the United States, Ichiro Fujisaki, our guest on WFAE. You've spent a lot of your life in this country, 4 years as ambassador, 4 years as political minister at the embassy in Washington. You were also your country's ambassador, I believe, to the United Nations for a period. And you studied here, first in the 1960s as a junior high school student in Seattle, and then a year each at Brown and Stanford. What was your first experience like as a junior high school student, as a child, as a young man? What was it like?
I came here in 1960, maybe a long time before you were born.
No. Unfortunately.
At the time, Japan started to see the U.S. television.
I'll tell you what, let me stop you there because we have to go to a break, and I've lost track of the time here this morning, so we'll follow up on that on the other side. Ambassador Ichiro Fujisaki from Japan. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is former ambassador to the United States from Japan, Ichiro Fujisaki, who was the ambassador here from 2008 to 2012. But his first time in this country was as a junior high exchange student in 1960 in Seattle. And I'm just wondering what that experience must have been like for a young Japanese boy.
Yeah. I was a seventh grader, and I joined the Catherine Blaine Junior High School as a newcomer to that school in Seattle, Washington. And that time, Japan was, the everyday life was so different from the United States. Japan was rather poor after the World War II, and we were just starting to watch American television. So television like Donna Reed Show, Rick Nelson Show, Father Knows Best, Bonanza.
And you were watching those in Japan.
Route 77, 66, and all that. And but the life was so different.
Yeah.
And we came to the United States and saw that, hey, there's this thing that I was seeing in Japan over television that was there. And, for example, to have ice cream in a refrigerator and can eat it every day was something like a dream. And Coca-Cola, that's only for Christmas or birthday thing. And you're having it every day. And the life was so different. And we didn't have cars in Japan, as in we were driving cars. And that was so different. So I was really... drawn into a dreamland from, and that's the first thing. And the second thing I say is that at the time, it was 30 or 40 years before the baseball player Ichiro came to Seattle Mariners, so no one was able to announce, to pronounce the name of Ichiro. So that it was Ichiro or Kiro or something like that. I enjoyed it, and I didn't speak a word of English at the time. So when I was going to school, my father and mother has to tell me that, hey, if someone approaches, just say, I don't speak English. And if nature calls, say, where's the restroom? And those things, and I went to the school. So
I'm curious, but in 1960 in Japan, watching American television shows in Japan,
People are speaking in Japanese.
Yes, but the culture was so different back then, and we were so separated. It's not the worldwide culture that it is today. We didn't have access through television and the internet to nations and cultures all over the world. It was pretty closed back then. Why would Japanese people want to watch the Donna Reed Show or the Rick Nelson Show or Father Knows Best? Why would they be interested in that? It's so foreign. Them.
Yeah, very much so. But Japanese television just started, and they didn't have so many
programs.
So they imported and translated it and showed it, and that was interesting. So we were watching it. Everyone was watching. That was the talking topic in schools. Did you see that film of Donna Reed Show? And still remember a lot of scenes.
So you had some exposure to the country before you came here.
Yeah.
Although some people think that everything they see from American movies and television is how life really is, and it really isn't that way. But our two cultures, our two languages, even our written languages, you have three different writing systems that are completely different from our own. The word order, I'm told, of Japanese is different from most other languages. How difficult was it for you to acclimate as a young person?
To tell you the truth, it was not that easy at the outset. There are people who are talented and who can grasp it right away. And my sisters didn't have as hard time as I did. And it was not so easy for me to sort of really go into English language world. The only thing that helped me was math. I was pretty good at math, and so I was accepted as a very good at math. But in other parts, you don't know any word, so you have to remember all the vocabularies, and it took a lot of time.
You didn't speak English. Did someone in that school in Seattle speak Japanese?
No.
How did you communicate? Did your host family speak Japanese?
No, I was with my family.
Oh, okay. Well, how did you communicate with teachers? How did they communicate with you? How did you learn anything?
Well, so slowly by slowly. But I had dictionaries and things like that. So.
Did your parents speak English?
Yes.
They did. Okay. You have two daughters who are now journalists, I'm told, in Japan.
Yes.
But they went to school for part of their lives, at least in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is in the Washington, D.C. suburbs when you were the ambassador. Did you ever worry that they were becoming too American?
No, but I thought they were very lucky. It was not easy for them, too, because they had to learn Japanese as well, and in Saturday schools, and had to follow American courses. So it was demanding, but I knew that in the end, it was very lucky for them to have sort of dual possibility of learning English and Japanese. And in their métier, they're not using English mm-hmm. at the time. But still, I think to open up to the world, I think it was very good.
Our culture seems to have permeated the world, and there's a plus side from our point of view to that, I'm sure, but there's negatives because it seems to take away some of the native indigenous cultures of countries like Japan and countries in Europe. Everywhere we go, we seem to dominate. Kentucky Fried Chicken and McDonald's and Coca-Cola are everywhere, and American films and television. Have we watered down the Japanese culture and the Asian culture in the other countries in that part of the world? And is that a danger? Do you consider that a danger? Because you're losing some of the uniqueness that is yours.
There could be that argument as well. But, you know, when my girl was 1 year old, we went to London from Japan. And she was approaching two, but she was so afraid. And she didn't see anything in Japan, in UK, London. So one day, but we were driving around London and she saw the sign of McDonald's. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, there it is. something she knew. So I think this thing that you said gives some reassurance to people that, hey, there's something I know in any of the country. And also, one thing I would say is that Japanese culture was not only destroyed by American culture, but it has come into American culture as well because of the cosmopolitanness of Japanese culture. For example, if you look at many of the Japanese architect, cuisine, fashion, those fashion of, for example, Issei Miyake or Koshino Junko or other top fashion designers have brought in Japanese tradition into American culture. Architects like Tadao Ando, they have brought in Japanese sort of thinking into, and so it's a sort of a merge or I think that has been working quite well.
Well, you've certainly had an impact in the automobile industry. every other car on the road is a Toyota. And, of course, Sony has been a major electronics firm. There are other electronics firms from Japan who dominate the electronics picture in this country. The U.S. seems to attract a lot of Japanese tourists. And given all the differences between our two countries, what makes this such an attractive destination as a vacation spot for Japanese tourists? They're everywhere, and they love to take pictures.
Mm. I think one thing is that everyone have, just like I've seen through a television show, have seen New York or California or Hawaii or Monument Valley or whatever through television or film, and they wanted to see that for their eyes, and that's one of the reasons. Second is that United States people are so warm and friendly, so that people feel at home. Third, I think exactly what you said about food and things like that. People are used to American culture already, so they don't feel so intimidated to go to somewhere too strange. They know that, hey, I already know this place and that.
Hmm. What seem to be, from the people that you know who come here as tourists, what are they most curious about before they come?
I think it depends on people. Someone would like to come to Washington and see the White House or Capitol and listen to some of the discussions there, or some people would like to go to New York and see the most cosmopolitan city. Someone would like to go to Hawaii or California, and it depends. So it really varies, but people feel sort of affinity or closeness with Americans. That is true.
You know, Japan is a, from this point of view, is a very pro-United States country, and that's a refreshing change in some cases, because many countries don't particularly care for us. If that impression is accurate, and I think that it is, why? Why is it that way? Why is Japan so pro-American?
I've seen polls that 80% of Japanese feel affinity towards the United States, and about 80% of Americans like Japan. Mm-hmm. And that's something very spectacular, because thinking of the fact that 6 years ago we were fighting, 70 years ago we were fighting, and we have such a different cultural background, and now we are such a close friend. So, as you say, this is phenomenal. Now, one thing I think Japan feels about the United States is it's a very strong country, but at the same time, maybe thanks to, this is my interpretation, your founding fathers, it's a principled country. You have democracy, human value, freedom of speech, and human rights, and these things are a set of principles that doesn't waver. From time to time, of course, there's a lot of discussion in United States. However, in general, these principles are there, so there's a predictability. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, gives a lot of assurance to people around the world, including Japanese, that U.S. is a trustworthy country.
How did you get over World War II and the fact that we bombed Nagasaki and Hiroshima, mm-hmm, with atomic weapons? How did you recover from that? How did you recover psychologically from that? How did you repair your thinking process toward this country over those two things?
I think this World War II, I was born after that, but is a very delicate, difficult issue. If we start focusing on World War II, there are things that Japanese would like to make some argument on, and Americans have that, Chinese would have that, Republic of Koreans would have that, and I think the best way is, of course, we have to face history issues squarely, but at the same time, not to be too much focusing on solely on that issue, but try to have a more positive, forward-looking attitude.
So that's difficult to do. How did you do it?
I think it's not that difficult. I think because just think, which would you be good for you to? Would you to focus on the past issues alone, or just? Of course, you have to recognize that, but at the same time, focus more on the positive side, which is better for you. And it's so evident, isn't it? Mm.
Ambassador Ichiro Fujisaki, a former ambassador from Japan to the United States, our guest today on Charlotte Talks. You are the president of the Japan-America Society, which I know has a branch in Charlotte. What is the Japan-America Society?
There's a Japan-American Society's more than 30 or 40 in the United States. That is a private organization's in order to promote friendship with Japan. Now, there's a counterpart in Japan. It's not a brand. It's an America-Japan Society, just like Japan Society's here.
Okay.
And there's an individual Society's about 30 in Japan.
Okay.
And there's a national association, and I'm president of Tokyo branch as well as a national association, which was established in 1917. So in 3 years' time, we'll have centennial,
wow,
100 years. And it's a private organization that we are trying to promote friendship with the United States through grassroots, in a way.
You spent most of your life working for the Japanese government in various different capacities, including as their ambassador to this country. You spent 40 years working for the Japanese government. What made you decide, A, to leave government after you ceased being your nation's ambassador to this country? And how unusual is it for a former ambassador to do what you're doing now?
Well, Very frankly, it was not my decision to. I was the most senior ambassador, having had 43 years, and I was already 65, and it was the time for me to leave. However, I now feel that it was lucky for me, because I was able to pick up other things. Mm-hmm. And if I stayed on for 5 more years, then I think that I would have done only one thing in my life, to be a diplomat, mm-hmm. being a diplomat. But now that I've retired, I am helping some private companies, teaching in universities, and head of these private organizations. And I do think that I appreciate those things.
For example, yeah. Go ahead.
I'm teaching every week in college, and try to mingle with young people, and try to convey what I have learned to younger people, and I enjoy it.
I have about a minute left in this segment. I'm just curious how difficult it is to be a diplomat, because you're working for your government, saying things that they want you to say, and you're dealing with people sometimes adversarially, but you have to be polite during the whole thing. How difficult? That's a tightrope you're walking there.
I think to be a diplomat, you need about 5 qualities to be sensitive to news like journalists. Mm-hmm. You have to be a good communicator and decision maker like a politician. You have to be detailed negotiator like lawyers. And also you have to be likable, and you have to be a manager. But you can't be everything, but you'll strive to be those. And
let's take a break. I have to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Right. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Ambassador Ichiro Fujisaki is with us, the Japanese ambassador to the U.S. from 2008 to 2012. He is here under the auspices of the World Affairs Council of Charlotte. He speaks today at noon at the City Club, and there are seats available for that if you'd like to go. I know that the U.S. and Japan have been working closely with the Republic of Korea on policy concerning North Korea. How worried is Japan, because you're so close to North Korea, how worried are you about Kim Jong-un and his regime?
Before that, can I answer your previous question a bit?
Being a diplomat? Sure.
Yeah. I think... being diplomat is not just a microphone conveying automatically what you are told from your headquarters to the U.S. government. It is that you would be there in the United States, so you know how the U.S. is working, U.S. is thinking, so you would convey that to Japan and try to advise to the home government that, hey, the direction that your government may take is not exactly in line with that, so you would try to sort of adjust it. And that's the major role, that in order to try to adjust between the two different governments.
But you're not always successful as that. World War II will attest to that. So,
exactly.
So it must be frustrating.
If not, then it would just be totally two different. So this could be some failures as well, but maybe there could be many successes which we have not seen, because it was successful as well, isn't it? Now, as for North Korea, yes, a lot of us are concerned about the thinking of that regime. And the regime, I think, is taking some positive attitude as well.
Madeleine Albright, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, called him called him crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Is he crazy?
I don't think so. It could be. I personally feel that it's not, of course, Secretary Albright is the wisest person, but if you call someone, the leader of other country, I don't know if she calls it crazy, but that would not bring anything good to the relations, would it? So I would not test that kind of argument that much, because if you say a word here, everyone would be listening very carefully.
Yes.
And would you be very happy if you're called that way? So I have to be rather careful on that. However, I think what we have to be thinking is that we know that he's put in a place where he has a limitation to move, but try to draw as much as possible from the other side. That is the negotiations.
But when somebody like that saber rattles against the United States, when he threatens us with nuclear weapons, etc., I mean, this is the United States versus this tiny little country that has no money, mm-hmm. and maybe and no at the moment, hopefully, no nuclear weapon. What is going on in his psyche that would make him feel that he should challenge us?
Let's take Iran. We were so much disappointed with Iran after Khomeini and have sanctioned them. And a lot of people said sanctions would not be that effective. And Iranians had been very antagonistic to United States and other countries. But in long run, because sanctions worked, they had to come around, and now they are trying to negotiate really seriously with the United States and others. I do not know if the parallel could be drawn, but sometimes negotiations take time, and patience is needed. And you don't have to take word by word what these dictators would say. You have to take them seriously at the same time, but mm-hmm. you have to weigh in their position and try to draw as much as possible from the other side. That is the diplomatic.
Do you think that China can and will be inclined to try and keep him in check?
I think so.
How concerned are you about China? Do you believe they have peaceful intentions, or are they a sleeping giant waiting for their moment to strike?
I do not know the strike thing, but China is an important partner for Japan as well for United States. One thing that is, as President Obama says, we need China to be successful. It's an important trading partner for United States, important trading partner for Japan as well. One thing that is a bit disturbing, if I may say, is that China's economic growth is directly translated to its military buildup as well. And it's already world's second largest military. Mm-hmm. And we think that it's still a country with huge poverty as well. And I think it would be better to translate its economic growth more to the welfare of people rather than to very rapid military growth.
I'm not sure of the timeline on this, but recently China declared an expansion of their air defense zone, which is something that obviously impacts Japan. Secretary of State John Kerry has said that the U.S. neither recognizes nor accepts that expansion, and he felt the need to stress our commitment to uphold our treaty obligations to our allies, which means our longstanding commitment to defend Japan if attacked. Why do you think he felt the need to say that again? I mean, do we really think an attack, that China would make an attack on Japan?
We do not accept that deed by China as well, to set up unilaterally air defense zone. And of course, any country can set up air defense zone, but they have declared that that zone, if any country would come in, they have to get the approval of China, and that zone includes Japanese territory as well.
Yeah, right.
So it could trigger some difficulty between China and other countries. And Korea was Republic of Korea was protesting to that as well. And I think we totally support what United States have been saying, that that kind of action cannot be accepted, and they will live up to, United States will live up to treaty obligation. That is very important, and we would like United States to keep saying this in order to deter any more aggression by China or any other country. I think in order to use military in that region is very dangerous, and U.S. has been the balancer, keeping peace and stability in that region. And we hope not only Japanese but Koreans or ASEAN countries or Australia would look upon the United States to keep that role as a country to keep peace and stability in that region, and we hope that will remain so. So that is the reason that Japan has been letting the United States use bases in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we've been there since the end of World War II. Wish that we remain in Germany. That's an important thing for you. That's why, although I know there's some unrest in some areas of Japan about our still being there, it's important that we stay.
Yes. Japan. The reason that there has been an issue is that 80% of U.S. forces is concentrated on the little island of Okinawa historically. Right. And the Okinawa people think that why do we have to carry that burden of having U.S. bases in our little island?
Mm-hmm.
That is the issue. But at the same time, we geographically speaking, geopolitically thinking that that's a very important area for us too. So it's not only U.S.-Japan issue, it's but Okinawa-Tokyo issue as well.
Actually, it's more like 65 years or 70 years and not 50 years. Japan is supposed to be the healthiest country in the world with an average lifespan of 83 years. What is it about the Japanese lifestyle or diet or what's going on there that you're so healthy? We'd like to know the secret.
Michael-san, you look very healthy as well. What kind of diet do you have? I have to follow your example.
Well, I eat a lot of Asian food, actually.
Yeah, they say that eating more fish and vegetables and those things have helped, but it's quickly changing after World War II. That Japanese are eating more and more meat and dairy products as well. It's maybe changing, but I don't know. Maybe we have a universal healthcare system as well. Has been there for a long time.
Talk about that. You have what's it like? How does it work? Who pays for it? What has it done to taxes?
It's a huge tax burden on Japan, but the people pays. But also, it's subsidized by government, everyone is universally under the healthcare system.
Does it slow things down? In other words, if you have a serious illness, can you see a doctor? Can you get treatment when you need it, or do you have to get in line?
I think we can get doctors, and of course, if you can get to the top doctor or if you have to go to a local doctor, whatever, that's a difference. But anyone can go to a doctor right away.
Do you understand? I'm sure that you were...
There are some things, for example, yeah, that this healthcare would not allow. For example, if you want to put in a very special planting to your teeth, you have to
do
it out of healthcare. This would do only standard things, but the standard things, almost everything could be taken care of by healthcare system.
I'm sure that you follow the debate in this country about healthcare and what has come out of that debate, which is the Affordable Care Act called Obamacare, and there are still people very angry about it and who are very suspicious about it and think it's the worst thing that's ever happened, and it makes us one step closer to being a socialist country. When you hear these arguments and you know what you have in Japan, what goes through your mind?
I think post-war Japan was created in a way by United States Occupation Army, and they brought in a system where inheritance taxes very high, and stripped land of landowners and given to farmers, and trying to bring in I don't know if it's a socialist, but a very equal society. Mm-hmm. So even the president of Toyota would not be having a huge house. I know his house, but it's not a huge mansion. It's everything is more to like an egalitarian society in Japan, and healthcare is part of that too.
Hmm. Does your acceptance of that stem from something cultural, or is it something that was imposed on you that you grew accustomed to?
I think it's the latter. It was not accustomed to. For example, we had a huge landowners or rich people before the war, and they thought that hey, it has concluded with the military and brought in the World War II. So mm-hmm. They changed the system, and now people are happy with that.
Ambassador Ichiro Fujisaki, a former ambassador from Japan to the United States, our guest today on Charlotte Talks. We haven't talked yet about the earthquake and tsunami and the disaster that it led to at Fukushima Daiichi, the power plant there. That power plant evidently produced an enormous amount of power, and in the aftermath of the tsunami, Japan shut down all of the nuclear power plants in the country. I'm not sure how many that is, 48 perhaps, I think, reactors involved in that. How have you been able to supply the country with power when you shut down a great many power plants?
First of all, I was ambassador when 3/11 happened, and mm-hmm. We were helped by people around the world, but on the top of the list were Americans. American military, American government, American people, American churches, American schools, including American kids, really stood with us. Some of the kids brought their birthday gift to us, and it was enormous, really, goodwill. So we are now coming back from that after 3 years, but not without help from people. And so we were really lucky to have Americans as our partners, and I have to say that we really owe a lot. So representing Japanese people, I would say arigatou gozaimasu. Thank you very much to all Americans which are listening to this radio. You have saved us the most difficult time in our history. Now, as for energy, you're right. We were number three in having nuclear power plants. Number one, United States. Number two, France. And number three was Japan. And Japan was 26% of our electricity was coming from nuclear power. And now no power plants is operating. Nuclear power plant is operating. And we are depending more and more on oil and natural gas. And we are starting to import natural gas from the United States, thanks, but we have to. Now Japan is facing a time, if we are to restart some of the nuclear power plants, or shall we do away with it? There's no consensus in Japan.
So a very big decision and no consensus on that decision yet among the citizens or among the government either.
The government is trying to consider this, but we have not come to a conclusion
yet. I want to thank you for the hour, Ambassador Ichiro Fujisaki.